And so it is the 27th day of August 2015 here on the Ocelli Effect. I am your host, Chuck Ocelli, and we are being heard live on American Freedom Radio at AmericanFreedomRadio.com. I do appreciate you, no matter how you are listening to this right now, whether it is further on down the stream or if you're catching us on one of the affiliate websites, etc., etc., you're all appreciated. What I have for you tonight, though, is... well, a serious rarity, because in all the years that I've studied the JFK case, I must say that one of the individuals that I have wanted to interview for probably a decade now is Abraham Bolden. Now, many of you may not have heard of Abraham Bolden. I'm learning that some things that I think are rather common knowledge are not so common among the general public. But interestingly enough, I mean, you may have seen Mr. Bolden on television. You may have heard him interviewed elsewhere, but I promise you this will not be exactly as you have seen him or heard him before because, well, I'm just an odd individual. So this is the way it'll go. And I'll tell you something. Even before we went on air, I even had to stop and question because I see him identified, and I had this discussion off air, and I'll share it with you guys right now. You know, I said to myself, it is really odd to me that there is an assumption that that he's automatically identified as an African American, you know, simply because of the complexion of his skin. And I wouldn't even bother to mention his ethnicity, except that it does play a vital role in the story that we're about to tell you. Okay, and it turns out that Mr. Bolden is quite content with being understood as an African American individual, but you know. During the time I grew up, we did generally identify individuals of darker complexion as black. But I'm more than happy to say that Mr. Bolden is, you know, first of all, a man of principle and a man that I really want you to get to know tonight in a different sort of way. Because this to me, again, is I don't know how to explain this. One of the unsung American heroes, in my estimation, who is not only due a pardon, but is also due an apology from the United States government, okay? And we're going to find out why in a few minutes. How are you tonight, Mr. Bolden?
Thank you very much for inviting me, Chuck, and I'm doing pretty good.
Well, I am glad to hear it, sir. You know, it is a fascinating story, and there's so much to tell. I kind of want to give you a chance to explain to people how it is you got into law enforcement, because that seemed to be the profession that you found yourself in before joining the Secret Service. I wonder if you could kind of explain that and kind of give people an idea of how you wound up being the first. Now, and again, I'm not sure about this, the first African-American who was a Secret Service agent, or were you simply the first African-American who was assigned to presidential detail?
Well, actually, I was both, because one of the other ones who was from the Belize Islands, who happened to be dark-complected, but he denied that he had anything in association with Negro, Africa, or Black. So that would make me the first Secret Service agent, Black Secret Service agent, as I see it. Also, I'm not campaigning for that honor, because I think the honor of having been the first black to be appointed to the Secret Service detail in Washington, D.C. under President John F. Kennedy is an award enough for me. It's a historical mark, a benefit to my whole race.
Well, absolutely. And this was a rarity at the time. I mean, and you were actually hand-selected. But as I said, I would like to get into what it is that brought you into law enforcement. And, you know, why is it that you chose that as a career? Or was it something that just happened?
Well, Chuck, I grew up in a rough neighborhood down in southern Illinois, East St. Louis, Illinois. And things worried me, the racial situation and the condition of my people down there, the crime that was going on. But I decided at an early age that I wanted to either become a lawyer or a musician. After I graduated from Lincoln University in Jefferson City, Missouri, having received a scholarship in music, I graduated with a BA in composition. But my heart was really on police work. And it came upon a chance. My wife happened to be reading the St. Louis Post-Dispatch and saw that Pinkerton National Detective Agency was hiring new detectives. Of course, Pinkerton at that time didn't have any black detectives on their roster. They had uniformed policemen who were guards at companies and factories, but they did not have any detectives. My wife happened to have been reading the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, and they were advertising for detectives. So I went over there, and I made an application, and that ended, started my entrance into law enforcement. I became the first black to be appointed as a Pinkerton detective nationwide. And so I was very, very well, you know, prepared to be, you might say, a trailblazer. And after that, I went into the Illinois State Police, where I stayed 4 years. I had Illinois State Police training and then became one of the first in the Illinois State Police Investigative Division under Captain Jack Lindeen. Now, when Kennedy was running for president, he came to Peoria, Illinois, where I was stationed as an Illinois state policeman. Now, I was very fond of President Kennedy, as many of my black brothers and sisters were. We thought that he was sincere. We thought that he wanted to try to bring peace among the racist during the 1960s period, and he happened to win the presidency. Now, I was appointed to the United States Secret Service in October of 1960 under President Eisenhower. But John Kennedy, after he won the election, he beat Nixon by some 8,000 votes in Cook County here, in Cook County, Chicago, and he decided to come to Chicago on April 28th of 1961 in order to thank Mayor Daley for the narrow victory that he achieved by 8,000 votes in Cook County. Mm-hmm. Now, the president, as I said, when he came to Chicago, there were assignments that were being given out to Secret Service agents where the president was going to be coming to speak at McCormick Place. The president arrived at McCormick Place at around 8:30 or so p.m. that night on April 28, 1961. Now, arrangement had been made by Mr. Gagland, Harry Gagland, to put me out of sight in front of a washroom on the lower level of McCormick Place, out of the way, you know, the president, the chances of me seeing the president in that position were almost slim to none. But in my position that was on the chart of assignments at the Secret Service when we were being assigned in positions on the evening of April the 27th was to be standing near the stage where the president was going to be speaking. Well, that was changed at the last minute, and they put me downstairs in the basement in front of the washroom. However, when the motorcade arrived at McCormick Place, the first thing that the president wanted to do was use the washroom in which I had been assigned to guard. And as I was standing there on duty, much to my surprise and but to my happiness, I saw the president as he was coming downstairs to use the washroom, in accompanied by Mayor Daley and practically every important politician in the state of Illinois. So you can see it was very ironic how we met. Now, the president stopped right in front of me as I was standing there in front of the washroom, and he asked me, was I a Secret Service agent or was I one of Mayor Daley's finest? That's meaning, was I one of Mayor Daley's policemen, detectives? And I answered, I'm one of the Secret Service agents, Mr. President. And the president, being the sincere man that he was, and he had already issued an order about 2 weeks before that the government had to hire Negroes in positions and that they had to make an accounting of the promotions and evaluations that they were being given to Negroes so that the government would be sure to be giving them a fair shot. But anyway, the president and I shook hands, and the president looked me in the eye and said, he asked me, he says, Mr. Bowling, he says, has there ever been a Negro assigned to the White House detail in Washington, D.C.? And I answered him, not to my knowledge, Mr. President. And to my surprise, he says, would you like to be the first? I said, yes, sir, Mr. President. And he said, I'd be looking forward to seeing you in Washington, D.C. And on June the 6th of 1961, I became the first Negro to be assigned to the presidential detail on the White House detail in Washington, D.C.
And that is amazing because, you know, as you said, no one had ever gotten that position who was, well, you're using the term Negro because that was contemporary with the time. That's exactly the term that would have been used then.
Yeah.
But no one of what we would say today would be African-American descent at that time had any sort of position of responsibility. I mean, in a lot of federal agencies prior to Kennedy's, declaration, because, I mean, even in the FBI, there were black agents, allegedly, but they were usually given menial jobs and things like this. They were never actually given serious investigative responsibilities or anything like that. I mean, how did you feel about that when that happened? I mean, did you kind of feel as though maybe it wasn't real, or did you think, did you think it was just an amazing coincidence? I mean, what struck your mind at that time when that whole exchange took place before you actually got to go?
It was just unbelievable that under these circumstances that I had met the President of the United States, whom I had admired so much, and I thought would do a terrific job in bringing this country together and giving everybody a fair shake. President Kennedy impressed me as a very dedicated person who did not want to give us an advantage as black people, but he did want to make the playing field level. He wanted everybody to have the same opportunity for progress. And so I was very impressed and very elated that he had recommended me to become the first Negro on the White House detail. Of course, after I arrived in Washington, D.C. on June the 6th of 1961, I was not very well received by some of the agents. It seems to me that that it was evident that I was breaking up a good old boys club. They had things situated pretty much like they wanted them, and it seemed like I was an interloper, a person who was not welcome in the good old boys club. And I think that everybody understands what I mean when I say that. Certain things happened and occurred. A hangman's noose were hung over my desk, and there were things that occurred in Washington, D.C., different assignments, and that really let me know where I stood so far as the Secret Service concerned.
Mm. Well, and there was also situations where they protested and said that you wouldn't be able to stay in hotel rooms with them if they went down south and things like this, right?
Yes, that's absolutely right. As a matter of fact, President went to Miami, Florida, on a trip, on a little trip that he and Jacqueline had, and they didn't take me there. And later, I discovered a memo that was left on my desk. A derogatory memo with a drawing of a Negro man with very curly hair and thick lips. On the reverse of the document, which was a memorandum that was written to the chief of the Secret Service saying that don't bring the Negro to Miami because if you do, we will not accommodate him in the hotel. And I put a copy of that letter in my book, The Echo from Dealey Plaza, to demonstrate just exactly what was going on so far as my status with the Secret Service was concerned. But I didn't go there to become an icebreaker. I was invited there by the President of the United States, and I just wanted to do my best to perform my duties to the people of the United States of America and to protect the President's life. To the best of my ability.
Hmm. Well, that's the thing. You were just simply an honorable man who had been given an unusual opportunity at that time, and what you were confronted with was well, let's be blunt. I mean, it was nothing short of just a continuous barrage of all sorts of racism. I mean, you got to they very clearly made remarks in your presence, from what I understand. You know. Directly related to, well, I mean, look, I'm just going to be harsh about some of the things that I've read, and I hope you don't take offense, but I mean, I've even read commentary where it was stated that they didn't want to take a bullet for someone who, you know, who was a, well, a Negro lover or this kind of thing. I mean, this was the types of statements that you were being confronted with as well?
Yes, absolutely. Now, What happened is this. When we went to Hyannisport, Massachusetts with President Kennedy, I noticed certain habits of conduct that was within the agents of the Secret Service that was detrimental to the life of the President of the United States, in that many of the agents that were surrounding the President, they seemed to be in a less than stable attitude regarding the President and his policies. They had lost the focus of the job that Congress had given the United States Secret Service to protect the presidency of the United States, and they had focused on the man who they disliked, many of them disliked very deeply. They called him an N-word lover, and they said that if anything should happen, if someone should try to assassinate him, they would not respond. Now, we have to understand, sir, that in the 1960s was a very, very volatile period within the history of America. Our people were being, black people were being lynched in Mississippi, and in the far south, there were the Freedom Bus Riots. We had the shootings. We had the assassinations were going on, and it was just horrible. There were riots in almost every city across the United States. So it was a very volatile time, and it affected not only the people that surrounded the President, but also the general public. However, the President, being the honest person that he was and the dedicated person that he was, had taken the side of right and not the side that many of the agents thought that he should take, which was to keep the Negro in his place, so to speak. And they believed in that so deeply that the agents, I heard a discussion while we were in Massachusetts, the agents were discussing whether or not they would protect the President if an assassination attempt would be made. And when they came to a conclusion that some of them would not protect the President, I thought that this was worthy of being brought to the immediate attention of the chief of the United States Secret Service. And when I returned back to Washington, D.C. on July the 7th of 1961, I immediately reported that to Chief U.E. Bauman, Ulysses E. Bauman, at the chief of the Secret Service office in the Treasury building. He promised me that he was going to look into it, but nothing ever happened. There were also things that I saw in the conduct of the Secret Service, the laxity, the drinking, the cabaret with different women, bringing women to the hotel, and just general misconduct, I thought, for an agent with the special obligation that we had concerning the President of the United States. And when I upbraided the agents concerning this conduct, I was told by one of my supervisors, Harvey Henderson was his name. He says, Bolden, and I says, what, Harvey? He says, I want to tell you something, and don't you ever forget it. You're a nigger, you were born a nigger, you're going to die a nigger, you'll never be anything else but a nigger, so act like one. This is what a supervisor told me. And I knew at that particular time that it was probably be time for me to exit my experience on the detail, because under the idea and the understanding that the situation was so volatile all across the United States, that to be confronted like that by a supervisor within the Secret Service was very dangerous, and something had to be done. So I asked to be transferred back to Chicago, Illinois, after explaining to the chief of the Secret Service everything that I've just outlined to you, who promised me, Secret Service chief promised me that he would look into these things, but it seems that the conduct continued.
Well, and even now, you know, in more modern times, you're still hearing about some of the same behaviors. Because, look, there's more than one aspect to this. There's the fact that their conduct outside of their disdain, you know, for you personally as a representative of being, you know, what you called an interloper and so on and so forth, it's more than that, because they were just, I mean, look, if you're drunk and you're womanizing and you're not paying attention to your job, that's a straight violation of everything that you're supposed to be sworn to do if you're in that position, okay? And the same thing, you thought even, listen, I'm causing a disturbance here among this. I'm not going to do any good here. You actually chose to be transferred away thinking that you were doing a good thing, I guess?
Yes, I asked to be transferred away because I knew that the volume of hate that I was receiving was very critical, and that if a person talked to you face-to-face, as my supervisor talked to me, and he had, you might say, control over the positions that I would be stationed on all around the White House and everywhere else, he could easily put me in a position of harm or of accident or purposely do me harm.
Or even blame if something went wrong, right?
Yes, that's right. Now, where the critical situation came in was when I predicted to the chief of the United States Secret Service and to Inspector Tom Kelly, who was an inspector with the United States Secret Service, when I predicted that if an assassination attempt would be made on President Kennedy, it would be successful because the agents would be in no condition whatsoever to respond. And on November the 22nd of 1963, that became a reality. And once that became a reality, then I knew that my days were numbered with the United States Secret Service, because they knew that for years I had been complaining about it, and I had predicted that the outcome of an attempt to assassinate President Kennedy would be successful.
Well, let's rewind to one thing, though, because 3 weeks earlier, before the assassination of President Kennedy, with the date that we all know at this point, November 22nd, 1963, 3 weeks earlier approximately, there was another situation that arose in the Chicago office, right?
Yes, absolutely. That, in fact, there were two situations that were going on at the same time. Now, when I first wrote in my book, The Echo from Dedeplatz, concerning the Chicago operation, and I think there was an author of a magazine who I spoke with once. I can't call his name right now at the particular time.
His name was Edwin Black.
Yes, Edwin Black, that's right. We discussed an article about gunmen who had come into Chicago around November the 1st, and we had got information that a landlady here in Chicago had discovered automatic rifles and weapons in a room that these people had, these Cubans had rented. Now, the Secret Service were assigned to investigate this. Over the last, I would say, 50 years, sir, the Secret Service and many of the investigators who came out of Washington, D.C., had been unable to, said that they were unable to substantiate this investigation that happened in Chicago. But just let me just give you a fact on it, that in October 1963, and I'm reading from a research that I'd done in order to make sure that what I was doing and telling the people of the United States in my book was true, that in October of 1963, there were three men who were in Plymouth, Michigan, and they were gun runners. Now, on about October of 30, these three men who were Cubans, two of them came to Chicago. They came in Chicago by plane. Now, these people were Sierra Hernandez, and a man named Berkman. Now, that corresponds exactly with the arrival of a hit team that I would say was a hit team that came into Chicago right around the time that the president was to attend the Army Air Force game at Soldier Field on about November the 2nd. Now, so when I saw this, I knew that I was not just, it was not a figment of my imagination, that the Bureau of Customs had indeed investigated three individuals and had turned that information over to the FBI, and that these men, in fact, came to Chicago and stayed at a hotel here in Chicago. The weapons were discovered by a landlady, and at that same time, we had an undercover agent in the organization, the DRE organization, with a man named Echeverry. Now, these people heard, our informant heard Echeverry state that the president was about to be assassinated. Now we're talking now on about November the 1st, and in late October. So, doing these investigations of the potential assassination of the president, the Secret Service agents, J. Lloyd Stocks and Tom Strong, who were assigned to investigate this report that we had received of persons coming in with telescopes, with rifles, with telescopic sights attached, we investigated that, and the Secret Service blew the investigation. It was terminated because the investigation was destroyed by the FBI by telling one of our informants, telling Echeverry and his group, the DRE, that the Secret Service had an informant, a plant within the organization. And so that that investigation was totally destroyed.
Mm. And that led to an interesting situation because, well, like you said, for all these years they have denied that, that this investigation existed. But first of all, you have your own memory. And secondly, you've been able to corroborate an exactly parallel situation, right?
Yes, absolutely. I had to do the research because there was a man named John Adams who was saying that this was a figment of my imagination and this was a made-up story in order to cloud the issue as to my so-called guilt of a crime against the United States. But it states clearly here, and it's been investigated by the Customs, U.S. Customs, who submitted reports. I have the FBI and CIA number of Echeverria, which was number 201-767-409, born September the 3rd, 1931. He was the person who said that the president was about to be assassinated, and he made this statement on about November the 21st of 1963.
So, after this, and of course there's been other allegations of investigations that turned up sort of different things going on, different plots against the president all over the country. It's pretty interesting that previous to November 22nd, 1963, it appears as though there was more than one plot against him, and one of them you actually end up uncovering. And not only that, but you had the wherewithal to understand that due to the conduct of the Secret Service agents who were charged with the protection of the president, they absolutely were putting him at risk.
Yes.
Simultaneously. Yeah.
Right. He was at severe risk. And we also had intercepted a conversation in Miami, Florida. Now, I want you to understand, sir, Chuck, that much of this was covered up and did not go before the American people. But American people have no knowledge of this, that a person whose name was Miltier had a conversation with one of our informants on the telephone. Now, the sheriff of Dade County in Miami, Florida, had a recording made of the conversation between this right winger Miltier and our informant. Miltier told the informant that the President Kennedy was about to be assassinated also. He said the same thing that Echeverria had said here in Chicago. And the informant asked Miltier, you really going to do it, huh? And Miltier said, it's a done deal. It's a done deal. Now, the Secret Service knew about this conversation. The informant asked Miltier, well, how are you going to go about doing this? And they said, we're going to put a guy in a tall building and we're going to give him a rifle with a telescopic sight, and that's the way we're going to get Kennedy. And we already have a fall guy set up. So you can see that this plan was well developed. This thing that happened in Dallas, Texas, and the thing that was about to happen in Chicago was already pre-programmed. It was set up, and they were going to kill the president in one of the three places, either Miami or Chicago or Dallas, Texas. And they traced him to Dallas, Texas, and they executed their plan. Mm.
And this Miltier you're talking about is not even just your average guy or anything. This individual actually was going around and collecting money to try and assassinate Dr. King at one point. There's all sorts of interesting information about who this guy was. He was definitely involved in the more extreme right wing factions who were quite against integration, who were quite against a lot of the policies of the Kennedy administration. They wanted no part of anything he was about to do.
Yes.
Okay, so I'm sure you're aware of all that.
Yes, I'm aware of it. Now, where I came into the picture was this. After that, the president was assassinated. I began to see suspicious activity designed to cover up the things that the Secret Service knew, the reports that had been generated in reference to the potential assassination of President Kennedy. Many of them were destroyed, some were changed, and many of the suspects were not interviewed either by the FBI re-interviewed or the Warren Commission. And I was thinking at the time that maybe the Warren Commission did not know that this was going on. So I wanted to go before the Warren Commission, and I was scheduled to go to Washington, D.C. in May of 1964, at which time I wanted to go before the Warren Commission and see if they were privy to some of this information that I had been complaining about and the investigations that of other people who were trying to assassinate President Kennedy that seemed to me what they were not getting this information. So, but I didn't know at the time, sir, that Kazantbak on about December the 6th, after which time the CIA, the FBI, the Secret Service chief met here in Chicago, and they had a big conference here in Chicago. Kazantbak issued a statement, issued a memo to Bill Moyers, who was one of President Johnson's advisors, that Oswald had to be found as the lone assassin of President Kennedy. I didn't know that that memo existed at that time. So when I went to Washington, D.C. and tried to contact J. Lee Rankin, who was counsel of the Warren Commission, I didn't know that I was being followed at the time. And I was being suspected of trying to, do what they thought that I would do once I got to Washington, D.C., and that is to bring some pressure on the Secret Service and the activity that led to the assassination of the President of the United States.
See, and once again, you were honestly attempting to do your duty, which was to inform the individuals who were allegedly investigating the situation that leads had not been followed, that proper investigative procedures had not been followed, based on your own personal knowledge. Plus, you were also going to enlighten them as to the negligence of the Secret Service in general. And that's what your plan was, right?
Yes, absolutely. That's what my plan was. Now, in reference to that, when I arrived in Washington, D.C. on May 17th of 1964, after I made the telephone call to the White House switchboard trying to get J. Lee Rankin's extension so that I could give him a call, the next day on the 18th of May, they picked me up and brought me back to Chicago and charged me with a crime. They had a fake setup where one of the individual counterfeiters that I had arrested a couple of times for counterfeiting money was accusing me of trying to enter into a conspiracy with him to solicit the sum of $50,000 from another counterfeiter named Joseph Spagnoli. Now, this was all false, and they absolutely knew that it was false, but the whole thing was to silence me and to make my word count for nothing, because they knew the things that I'm telling you right now. They wanted to discredit them in advance by discrediting me and my character.
Well, and they even went so far as to manipulate the proceedings, because I've read about these proceedings. You know, this farce of a trial that you were supposed to have gone through was absolutely ludicrous. I wonder if you wouldn't tell people a little bit about that. You know, because, look, it's an interesting kind of point to think that you had been, okay, if you're being convicted of a crime, you know, then maybe your word wasn't worth anything, okay? That's obviously what they were trying to do. And, well, gee, it was just a, excuse me for saying it, but it was just a CYA kind of move here to try and shut you down and shut you up. I mean, that's what it was, and they went even as far as to make a complete farce of the trial, didn't they?
Yes, they did. I had two trials, as a matter of fact. In the first trial, after the testimony had been generated and the jury began to deliberate, the judge called the jury out and gave them an additional instruction. He said, in my opinion, the evidence shows that the defendant is guilty. Now, the judge said, you can disagree with me if you want to. Now, but go back in and take into consideration the instruction that I just gave you, which was to find me guilty. Now, this prerogative that the judge had used hadn't been used since the Magna Carta. It had only been used one time since the Magna Carta. And this judge wanted the jury to influence my jury to find me guilty. And that's what he used. Now, you have to understand that there have been many criminal trials since my trial in 1964. We've had governors to go on trial. We've had senators on trial. We've had mafia men on trial. But no federal district judge has ever since that time told a jury that, in their opinion, the defendant was guilty. We've had multiple murderers in state cases. But this prerogative of a judge was never used. Now, in the second trial, which ended on August 11, 1964, the judge cleared the courtroom. He put me and my attorney and all of the members of society who were not federal agents, he put us out of the courtroom, locked the doors, put us all the way out of the court building, chained down the doors, and the only people that were left in the courtroom was the judge and federal agents and the jury. And at that time, the jury allegedly returned a verdict of guilty. Of course, the files of the trial were missing for the next 25 years. We didn't find anything pertaining to that trial for 25 years later. From 1964 until 1995, the transcripts of the trial went missing.
That's just amazing. I mean, to put the public outside, to put yourself, your lawyer outside the courtroom. I mean, I don't even understand how they were able to get away with that.
Well, the Court of Appeals upheld it. It said that that the judge did not show any prejudice by giving the jury, telling the jury of his opinion. Now, you know, prejudice during that time, I guess when the Klansmen would lynch a black down in the South, you couldn't call them prejudice. They thought it was right. I mean, it's according to who's looking at it, but according to the law, that was clear judicial prejudice. The judge acted as jury, acted as a part of the jury, and not only that, the same judge heard a second trial of the same issue. He refused to recuse himself. So you can see how bad they had it in for me and my family. My family suffered dearly for that. My wife began to get ill, and she passed away in 2005. They sent me to Springfield Medical Center, which is a four-tiered institution. They have there the hospital. They also have the psychiatric division. They have a camp there, and it's also a terminal point for transferring prisoners from the east-west to east and west coast. Now, they put me in the camp there at Springfield Medical Center in Springfield, Missouri. But on July the 7th of 1967, at about 3 o'clock in the morning, they came to my bunk and removed me from the camp, took me over secretly to 21 East, which was the psychiatric division, forced me to take medical drugs for no reason whatsoever. They gave me tropic drugs and tried to declare me insane.
So not only did they destroy your life and destroy your family's life, you know, by imprisoning you, by making you a felon, But then on top of it, they wind up forcibly drugging you, keeping you institutionalized, not granting you your constitutional rights to a fair trial. All of this. I mean, do you think that this was mainly motivated by the information you had, or do you think it was especially vicious because of your race, sir?
Well, I think race played a big part in it, but I also know for a fact that the Kennedy matter also played a big role in it, too, because they knew, as Inspector McCain told me when they brought me back to Chicago, "You're not a team player." Those was his exact words. And he says, "We're not going to stand by and let you destroy all of our retirement and the work that we'll put in with the U.S. Secret Service." That was Inspector McCain's instruction to me. And so it seemed to me that they were more interested in maintaining the authenticity of the Secret Service than they were with protecting the life of the President of the United States.
Mm. And meanwhile, they had failed. They had absolutely failed on November 22nd, 1963, and they had also, you know, and again, let's point out something here. It wasn't a matter of the individual, John F. Kennedy, that was their responsibility. It was to protect whomever occupied the office of the President of the United States.
Yeah,
okay?
That's right. That was our duty.
That was exactly what your duty was. It wasn't about the individual necessarily, but it was about on behalf of the American people, you were there to defend the life of the individual who was supposed to be their elected leader. Okay? I find it so horrendous in my mind to think that this is what was done when all you were trying to do was to alert the authorities that were supposed to be, you know, policing this, taking care of it, making sure that the job was being done properly. You're trying to alert them to what's going on and the investigative agency after the man is murdered. You know, I mean, he was publicly executed in Dallas. I mean, bottom line, after that happens, they're allegedly investigating it. And all you're trying to do is offer them the information that, listen, you know, the Secret Service failed here. And this is why they failed, in my estimation, and you should look into this, and maybe you don't realize that there was other leads that weren't followed up. And it sounds to me like you were being a diligent and honest human being trying to do his job despite the wave of things against you. And then on top of it, they destroy your life, they destroy your name, you know, and ever after, I mean, you were horrendously punished for trying to do what is right.
Yes, that's right. And then when I took the case back, I filed a writ of habeas corpus here in Chicago in 1995, and the judge ruled that the writ was denied because I could not show that my treatment had disadvantaged me in any way. This is the way the judge put it. So you can see that they regarded my rights as nothing, but they didn't really take away my life, sir, because this is my life. I'm still here. I'm 80 years old. There have been a couple of agents who committed suicide who were in a trial and lied in their testimony about me. By the way, Spagnoli admitted before this same judge that he lied, that he and Frank Jones cooked up the whole case against me, and that the U.S. government attorney, Richard Seitz, prompted him to lie and gave him the testimony to testify falsely against me in court. Of course, the United States Court of Appeals still upheld the conviction, and the Supreme Court upheld it, refused to grant certiorari, and I was sentenced to 6 years in the penitentiary.
How much time did you actually serve, and when did you get out?
I served 3 years and 3 months. I got out on September the 25th of 1969. Now, the reason they did that, I was sentenced to 6 years, after 4 years on a 6-year sentence, I would have completed all of my obligations so far as a 6-year sentence would be concerned while in custody. So what they did, they waited until I had served 3 years and 3 months in a penitentiary, then gave me a parole. So this extended the time that I would be under government jurisdiction for 2.5 more years. So I would have to report to a parole officer and go through the different sign-ins and letting the government know where I was and things like that. But I want to tell the American public this, is that the greatest injustice about this whole thing happened to my family. Whenever I would get a visit from an attorney or from someone who was trying to aid me, then something would happen here back here in Chicago. Say, for instance, I talked.
Into the room with your pencil in your hand. You see somebody naked and you say, who is that man? You try so hard but you don't understand just what you will say when you get home, because something is happening here but you don't know what it is. Do you, Mr. Jones? You raise up your head and you ask, is this where it is? Then somebody points to you and says, it's his. And you say, what's mine? And somebody else says, well, what is? And you say, oh my God, am I here all alone? But something is happening and you don't know what it is. Do you, Mr. Jones? You hand in your ticket and you go watch the geek, who immediately walks up to you when he hears you speak and says, how does it feel to be such a freak? And you say, impossible, as he hands you a bone. And something is happening here, but you don't know what it is. Do you, Mr. Jones? You have many contacts among the lumberjacks to get you facts when someone attacks your imagination. But nobody has any respect anyway. They already expect you to all give a check to tax-deductible charity organizations. The professors and they've all liked your looks. With great lawyers you have discussed lepers and crooks. You've been through all of F. Scott Fitzgerald's books. You're very well read, it's well known. But something is happening here and you don't know what it is. Do you, Mr. Jones? Well, the sword swallower, he comes up to you and then he kneels. He crosses himself and then he...
to the world's meeting place. American.
It's practically narcotic.
Freedom.
Oh, yes. I like very much.
Radio.
You're an American institution.
American Freedom Radio.
Did you know there are 3 million edible food plants on Earth, and none have the nutritional value of the hemp plant? HempUSA.org offers you hemp protein powder. It does not contain chemicals or THC, is non-GMO, and is 100% gluten-free. Hemp protein powder burns fat, builds muscle, contains 53% protein, and feeds the body the nutrients it needs. Call 888-910-4367 and see what our powder, seeds, and oil can do for you. Only at HempUSA.org. HempUSA.org introduces 3 brand new detox formulations of microplant powders. Brain Fuel for depression, bipolar disorders, and stress. Total Care, anti-cancer agent that cleans the liver and organs and increases memory. Rejuvenate, invigorates and heals the body, mind, and spirit. These products are your alternative to pharmaceuticals. Call 888-910-4367 and like us on Facebook. We ship worldwide. Only at HempUSA.org.
American Freedom Radio is back. We're trying to become commercial free, apart from a few honourable advertisers that we would give ad space to even if they couldn't pay us. In this quest to deliver quality radio with very few annoying ads, we are now asking the listeners like you to open up and become partners with American Freedom Radio. We all know the economy is controlled, and a new system called the peer-to-peer economy is now within our grasp. That means if you'd like this network with its incredible hosts and credible information to be nothing but the content you want to hear, then you must realize that you cannot be a part of it if you're just sitting on the sidelines watching. Go to AmericanFreedomRadio.com and pledge your support today. Donate according to your means. Some can only afford $1 a month, while others can afford $100 a month. Regardless of the size of your contribution, it all adds up to keeping the network owners and the radio hosts housed and fed at the end of every month. Thank you.
We are living in a new era. Partnerships are more important than profit, and gratitude is more respected than greed. As the millennial generation evolves the corporate landscape, our company aims to maximize the achievements of CBD application and push the limits of what's possible by 2020. Our core product matrix and careful cannabidiol purification process are uniquely designed to be privately made in different regions of the world and is geared to assist the efforts of different nations to change the landscape of various pain-related healthcare costs, epilepsy and autism, rising mental disorders, and even soldier suicides. Crystal Pure CBD is made with the industry's finest 99.9% pure CBD crystals. No paste, no filler. Our solution is a permanent answer, and it saves you over one-third in cost. Crystal Pure CBD. Come join us.
You're listening to AmericanFreedomRadio.com, the network who perseveres in delivering intelligent debate, constructive dialogue with true independence. The freedom to broadcast the truth is not free at all. So what is American Freedom Radio worth to you? The empowering information with fun, honest and pure integrity behind it provides an example to follow. Friendships to flourish with the moral altruism that pulls no punches. The hosts sacrifice and show remarkable discipline in their duty to deliver quality radio in service to the community with strength, wisdom, and loyalty. The founders of AFR wish to thank you personally for sharing your views and insights to make the best radio and alternative media. Now it's time for you to give something back and play a vital role in the future of America. Be as generous with us as we've been with you. Click on the donate banner at AmericanFreedomRadio.com or volunteer by emailing AmericanFreedomRadio.com. Vaccines, psychotropic drugs, and artillery batteries not included.
No rules, no rules, no taboo topics, no taboo topics, no fear of doom, no fear of doom. We are American Freedom Radio, American Freedom Radio.
Boy, I'll tell you, every time you mention government and torture and you want to start describing the damage done to an American citizen, okay, our friends over at those .gov addresses that just happen to show up at certain websites at certain times seem to cause wonderful disturbances. So we want to talk about terrorist acts against an American citizen, which was what was going on with Mr. Bolden while he was locked up away from his family, his house having been actually shot at. I think that's what he was trying to say before he was so rudely interrupted. Okay. I wanted to get across that point, let him finish it, first of all. And then secondly, you know, there's a far more important purpose to this, not just to tell you about The Echo from Dealey Plaza, which is the book where you can find all of the information we've discussed tonight, but a whole lot more about Mr. Bolden and his experiences. But also, there is a campaign to exonerate him, to seek to have his record expunged, to ask for a pardon, etc., etc. And as I said before the show and during the show, this man not only deserves a pardon, but an apology from the United States government. Now, I have Mr. Bolden back on the line, and I do want to allow him to finish the point about what was happening to his family when he had wound up discussing things with Mark Lane, and then all of a sudden, your home was under attack, wasn't it, sir?
Yes, that's right. A bullet was fired into the bedroom of my children. I was just missing my young son. Also, when I had a visit from John Houseman while I was in Springfield, Missouri, my garage was set afire, the whole house was set ablaze. And this was like a warning to me each time that I would try to reach out to the public while I was incarcerated. Something would happen here. My car windows were smashed. My wife went to work and she came out. Somebody had smashed her car windows. And all of these things were just, it was too much to be a coincidence. But I still was hesitant to believe that we were being attacked, you know, as viciously as we were. I just couldn't understand it because this is America. And, you know, I got a lot of respect for the country, and I was just hoping that there was no connection, but it seems to me that it was.
Well, yeah, absolutely. It's not a mere coincidence if every single time you seek to reach out for some sort of legal assistance, some sort of remedy to the, I have no other word except injustice for which was visited upon you and also your family at this point, that some act of, well, let's be honest, this is what terrorism actually is, the attempt to terrorize your family, to silence you through fear. I mean, I have no better word except terrorism. And, gee, who else would have had that knowledge? I mean, look, we can sit here and speculate all day, but it doesn't really matter. It was a horrible situation for them to have endured. And as you said, it did also contribute to your wife's deteriorating health later. And things like that. It must have been absolutely awful to have had to go through that. And I'm amazed that you don't feel as though some of your life was taken from you. I got to say, it is an amazing act of forgiveness to even say that on your part, and something that I don't even think I am personally capable of, sir. But you do say that, you know, you have survived it, you have lived through it, you are still alive now, and they have not taken your life from you, and I commend you even for that sentiment. Now, moving forward, after you had finished your parole and everything else, when did the campaign to exonerate you begin? Because that's the last thing I want to touch on with you.
Well, we began a campaign to exonerate approximately 3 years ago. And we drew up a petition, which is can be located by contacting. I think you have the address of the petition, don't you?
I have the address for several petitions, and I'll be more than happy to provide them along with the show links tonight for the listener out there. And if I do turn this into a YouTube video, I will put it everywhere that this goes. Okay, to give you guys, there's officially one at the whitehouse.gov website. which is directed to President Obama, who, as a departing president, has the ability to grant pardons. Okay? They all do. This is just a fact of the office. He could just, with the stroke of a pen, remedy this stain on your record, at least. He can't give you back the years that were taken from you. He can't give you back your wife's health. But he could give you back your dignity in a legal and public way by doing so. And as I don't have a great deal of respect for President Obama personally, this would certainly earn a great deal of respect from me and a great many other Americans who absolutely support the need for you to be exonerated and for your record to be expunged. Okay, sorry I went through that statement, but I felt as though I had to make it, sir.
I appreciate it very much, sir.
And and these things, I guarantee I will give you that. You can find it through whitehouse.gov, okay? You can find, there's actually a Facebook group devoted to it. It is all over the place, and I have actually signed a couple of them because there's been a couple of physical petitions which have been circulated. This effort has been going on for the past few years, and I think is long, long overdue. And I know we got interrupted here and everything, and I know that I've overran the amount of time that you wanted to spend here tonight, and I do apologize for that. But I do want to give you the opportunity to say whatever it is you wish here, and I'll just simply be quiet. And, you know, whatever it is you'd like for the listener to take away from this interview, in regard to your personal story or in regard to the system in general, whatever it is you want to speak on, sir, the floor is yours.
Well, I would just like to tell American people that a tragic thing happened on November the 22nd, 1963. We lost a great man and a great president. We also lost a symbol of freedom. We have seen a decline in the amount of freedom since the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. And we have seen this country move from a positive to a negative atmosphere. It is my sincere hope that the American people will someday receive the truth, and that the files of the assassination of President John F. Kennedy be released to the public. Thank you very much.
And I do appreciate you, sir. And absolutely, I am extremely grateful that you took this time with us tonight. And I am sorry again for the interruption and the overrun of time, but extremely privileged, I feel, to have had you on this show. And one of these days, I also wish to conduct a private interview with you, which will not sound like this because it won't be for the listener. It would be to get at certain details. And and hopefully I'll be able to arrange that with you and make some time, because for my own personal research, I would like to get your account of certain things. So anyway, Abraham Bolden, is there anywhere that you would like to be reached by any listeners who are interested in assisting with your exoneration or questions or anything else? And obviously, as I said before, the book is The Echo from Dealey Plaza. It's easily found on Amazon and various other booksellers. Unless you have a particular place you'd like people to go buy it or anything like that, you know, please go ahead and tell the people.
They can reach me at a.bolden@sbcglobal.net. And that's my email address. And if anyone want to order an autographed copy of the book, just write me at that email address, and I will tell you how that you can get an autographed soft copy of the book, and the price is $15 plus $5 mailing charge.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. And I do appreciate your time once again, sir. And I hope that actually we can do this again and maybe get through a couple of more details about your story, because it is absolutely amazing and remarkable that you still maintain your character through all of this, regardless of what was done to you. And I really do salute you. And I do not feel bad at all about saying that you were very much like Jackie Robinson was to baseball. This is what Abraham Bolden is to the Secret Service and to law enforcement. And in fact, to be honest with you, an even more honorable man in my eyes than many of the other individuals who are, you know, quite pivotal figures in what is currently deemed as African American history, and definitely one of the least recognized. And I do believe it is time for you to be recognized and exonerated as well. So, Mr. President, let's get on it. Anyway, thank you, Mr. Bolden.
Thank you very much, sir.
So, this is the story, and, you know, I still have time here on the air to discuss it, and Mr. Bolden is going to probably hang up now. But, you know, this is one of the stories that emerged for me as a researcher, as someone who actually, you know, not only just cared about the assassination or the details of the assassination, the sort of necessary conclusion that one needs to reach about it, that it wasn't simply this lone nut who by happenstance pulled off some interesting act of, well, marksmanship, etc. Okay, on November 22nd, 1963. All right, but it is also one of these points in history that needs to be examined fully. I mean, Abraham Bolden's story is unique in that it does tell us a great deal about the history of this country regarding race relations, regarding, you know, some of these assertions that have been made many, many years later by other Secret Service agents who did not treat this man kindly. And I'll tell you what, if he had a little more time, believe me, I would have gotten into some of the commentary that was issued, you know, during the time that the Kennedy Detail book tour had gone on, okay, around this country a couple of years ago, and exactly how revolting I found that entire situation. Because in my estimation, the individuals that were involved in that revival, in that need to extol no blame upon the agency which was charged with protecting the life of the president on that day, kind of in a way blaming the president himself for his own assassination. Well, a damn fool got himself killed because he wouldn't let us stand on the back of the limo or whatever else because he wanted to be seen by the people. And maybe it was him who asked for the top to be removed and, oh, lots of other speculations and wonderful stuff. And meanwhile, the only guy who actually visibly did his job on that day was Clint Hill. And, well, there's a lot more to that story, too. Anyway, guys, if you want to join in on the conversation, things did not go quite as planned tonight, but listen, I'm doing the best I can, and it is live radio, so things do happen. But the number is 218-339-8525 if you want to join in on the conversation. If you have any sort of feedback you want to, expound upon here today regarding the story of Abraham Bolden, regarding how I conducted the interview, if you want to yell at me because I didn't let him talk enough and we didn't get to everything, that's fine too. Whatever it is you want to say, 218-339-8525. And if you are on my Skype list, you can send in text, okay, but I can't take calls. And, another amazing instance, though, where I see as soon as we bring up the malfeasance of a federal agency, all of a sudden technical difficulties that never arise during any other time seem to just appear. Anyway, so back to the story of Abraham Bolden. Again, you know, it is... It's an unfortunate and ugly thing to have to sit and discuss race issues in the way that we had to tonight. And, you know, for some people, you're probably thinking, look, Chuck, you're being oversensitive. You're falling into the politically correct area. I'm not falling into politically correct areas. It's just that it's a different reality from what we're confronted with today. It really is. Although when you do look at the conduct of individuals around the country, you know, and policing agencies and their behaviors toward, well, let's see now, African Americans, non-whites in America, it is notable that there is still a disparity. It is, again, notable that there is still a resonant problem regarding, you know, look what happened in Baltimore, look what happened in Ferguson. And of course, I do recognize that there is the larger issue here of the police state, of the rising and ridiculous and out of control governmental agencies who have incrementally imploded our personal freedoms and have done nothing but, you know, expand their own power over us, the citizens of this country, right? I mean, I recognize that as well. But to say that there is no disparity, to say that there is no treatment based on race in this country is just intellectually dishonest. This still does occur, maybe not to the degree, maybe not with the blatant sort of, well, what can I say, brazen language that it used to occur and whatever else, and maybe authorities don't turn their backs as easily on these types of behaviors as they once did, it does not mean that it is a completely irrelevant issue. Okay? And I know I'm going to get all kinds of nasty crap about that, but you know what? Reality is reality, and if you don't want to face it, what can I say? I don't know why you're listening to me. Because this is my goal, is to try and unwrap the present that they've given us, which is the delusion of the country of formerly known as the United States of America, right? The currently occupied, formerly united corporate states of what was allegedly America. Yeah, yeah, it's time to unwrap that present and get really into what's in the box. So, this is what's going on. I'm kind of surprised that I only had the callers in the first hour, and then, of course, network things going haywire. Nobody comes back in, but that's okay. In case you do want to, though, 218-339-8525, 218-339-8525. That is the number in case you want to engage in this conversation with me. So, again, moving forward with this entire story, there's a great deal more to it, and I do suggest that you read the article from Edwin Black, which did explain about this alleged hit team that winds up showing up. And this we're talking about is November 2nd, right? So it's 20 days before the assassination. This whole play goes on in Chicago. Okay, and it is it has been, you know, dubbed the Chicago plot in JFK research circles. If you go and look that up online, you'll find that there's a great deal of information. You'll also find that there was other things that were touched that were not touched upon here regarding a guy named Thomas Arthur Valley, or a valet, depending on how you want to pronounce it. You know, coincidentally, another ex-Marine who has allegedly radical ties or radical ideologies, and seems to have been easily framed into the, well, kooky kid who was misguided sort of framework that Oswald ends up being placed into much later. This guy was actually detained at one point by individuals in the Chicago police force there. And kind of unlawfully, as they had done many, many times and were called on the carpet for later. All right. Valley is an interesting figure, but not necessarily pertinent to Abraham's story, or Mr. Bolden's story, I should say. The concept that whole thing went on in Miami, you know, I didn't want to argue with him too much, but I don't put a lot of stock into the Miltier thing because he was quite the consummate con man who was looking to be an agitator, definitely someone who was against the concept of integration, had a very hateful sort of spin about Dr. King. And actually, I did bring it up, that he was literally raising money to have Martin Luther King Jr. assassinated. This is one of the many provable things that Joseph Miltier was involved in. And, of course, the tape-recorded conversation took place between himself and an informant named Willie Somerset. I don't take into consideration very heavily the concept that Miltier was present in Dealey Plaza and all this other, which I would categorize as mythology. Now, did he have foreknowledge? It seems so, because it's eerily similar when the man says that it'll be done from a tall office building with a high-powered rifle, which is exactly the scenario that emerges, you know, a couple of months later, really, regarding Kennedy's actual assassination details, although I do contend that the headshot to Kennedy certainly didn't emerge from the sixth floor of the school book depository building. Special note, by the way, Thomas Arthur Valley also worked in a building which was overlooking the planned parade route in Chicago. Okay, actually had possession of an old beat-up rifle and seemed to be exactly the kind of guy who was disenchanted with the United States and its policies and the president and so on and so forth. And these are little tidbits that they don't like to tell you because, after all, and according to my own personal research over time, not only was there a plot in Chicago, there was certainly a plot in a couple of different places in Florida. Not necessarily the Miltier plot either, but parade routes had to be changed, trips had to be canceled, and everything else because of legitimate suspicions that were investigated by the Secret Service, never really completely followed through on, but there was enough of a threat in order to change the planning of parade routes and travel routes and, of course, trips and things like this. So that occurred in those two cities, and I'm quite satisfied that there was also a possibility of a plot in Los Angeles. I've heard many different stories. I mean, you know, if I took every single possible plot across the country, you know, there are some people that have never bumped into a conspiracy theory that they did not love and therefore can find you 10 or 15 plots, but I'm telling you, in all honesty, I can find solid evidence for 3 to 4 assassination scenarios in the months leading up to Kennedy's assassination on November 22nd, 1963. So if you assume that I'm only half right, there is still duplicate plots with various aspects of their scenarios being similar. Being nearly the same, in fact. Like I said, an ex-Marine in some cases, parade routes on office buildings, with elevated positions, really badly picked out routes and things like this, all kinds of stuff. And they did actually cancel the trip to Chicago that was being proposed for November 2nd. And there was a poor excuse that Kennedy had had a cold or some nonsense given to the press, who was all lined up for his arrival there in Chicago in advance of it. Okay. And in fact, one of the arrangements had been changed in Florida at one point where another similar type motorcade was supposed to commence. And believe it or not, you wound up flying him in using like a helicopter or something like this to fly him into the location instead of driving him through a parade route through, you know, some sort of shooting gallery setup like we had in Dealey Plaza. Well, they avoided that because information had leaked to individuals trying to do their job, albeit some of them not so well. So there was enough of an alarm raised in other cities to cause travel plans to be changed, in order to avoid the assassination. Of course, in Dallas, which was a known hostile city to the president and to, well, politicians in general, even the well, the ambassador to the United Nations, Adlai Stevenson, who had previously been a presidential candidate and was considered rather liberal and was definitely a high-profile member of the Kennedy administration, you know, as an advisor and also, as I said, the ambassador to the UN for the United States, had actually been accosted in Dallas, only a few weeks before the assassination. It was pretty much a hotbed. There was a lot going on there, and they don't like it very much when you bring this up. You know, people talk about, well, gee, Dallas was sort of hung with the title of, you know, being the city of hate, being the place where the president was killed, et cetera, et cetera. You know, this was part of the reality as well in the aftermath of the assassination. Of course, a completely botched police, you know, action. Gee, police action, that's funny. You know, investigation by the DPD, which, you know, resembled, in my estimation, like a Keystone Cops kind of event. Didn't help, and the national spotlight being what it was. And, of course, let's not forget that that was also the first day that the news truly went live, 24 hours. So it is all these things that you need to place into context when looking at Abraham Bolden's story. And, you know, I've spoken about this before, and I haven't actually had the opportunity to interview Mr. Bolden about some of these details. There are a great many details I'd like to know about. But tonight's presentation was about getting out the general story, and believe me, if I was conducting a private interview, it would sound nothing like what we attempted to do tonight, even though we were quite rudely interrupted. And once again, I want to thank my listeners somewhere on the East Coast who do find it necessary to interfere every time that I bring up some sort of government agency of the United States having been involved in torture or terrorism or something like that. Well, you know, the implications of that are pretty nasty, I guess. And it's a good thing to knock me off the air and keep me off my game so that I don't keep exposing that. But, yeah, that's not going to work, fellas. It's just not going to happen. I'm going to keep at it, and I don't care if it's, you know, I have had Dr. Frank Gregory Ford on here to discuss being the only intelligence operative in U.S. history to ever be renditioned and survive. Abraham Bolden having been forcibly drugged, wrongfully convicted in a kangaroo court setting. You know, and believe me, there's more to come. If you keep listening to the show, you're going to find out that I've got a particular nasty sort of habit of needing to expose this type of disgusting behavior, because after all, it is being conducted under the guise of defending all of us. See, don't forget that no matter what it is we're talking about, when the U.S. government is acting, is doing these things, is participating in torture, incarceration, you know, the absolute theft of an individual's human rights in one way or another, all of that is being done in you, the United States citizen's name. Isn't that lovely? Well, so that's not going to stop regardless of what happens interference-wise. I don't care if the recordings disappear, whatever. I'm going to keep talking about it, and I'll keep revisiting these topics. So that's the way that's going to go. But I do thank my friends in Langley and elsewhere, you know, who are engaged in making sure that electronic interference is possible in the strangest and most unique and innovative ways. I do want to thank you for continuing to listen, because it means that I'm actually saying something of value. But anyway, back to it, like I said, you know, about Mr. Bolden's story, it's one of those things that just absolutely aggravates me and is necessary. And notice, as respectful and calm, and he's also like a man of faith, and, you know, I didn't even want to get into that tonight at all, because we didn't have time really to examine him as an individual in quite the way that I wanted. You know, he's one of these guys that's very spiritual about it, doesn't want to sit here and hold a grudge, but still what's fair is fair and what's right is right when it comes to these things. It's pretty amazing in my estimation. I really don't know if I could do the same as he is doing. I don't know if I could walk the same walk and have the attitude that he's had. Of course, he wants to alert you, the people, to the reality of the situation that he endured. But really, it's so that the mistake is not repeated somehow. And in light of that, you know, what is highly, highly fascinating to me also is that, well, how shall I put this? It's not just to enlighten individuals as to the ugly history. It's not just to alert people as to the personal injustices that he had to endure. But also, notice the point that was slipped in there, that he realizes that since that day, okay, since that day in Dallas, since that day that our alleged leader was publicly executed, since that day, he does see the absolute incremental decline in the personal freedoms of the people in this country. Makes you wonder, not at all, why I constantly say that he was actually the last legitimate president that we had on our side. Although I almost want to make an exception for Jimmy Carter because, well, I think his hands were tied and that he really wanted to do a whole lot more than he did. But, you know, it's difficult to know with these guys because almost none of them ever reached that higher echelon anymore, or at least post November 22nd, 1963. They absolutely don't reach that higher echelon of politics without being corruptible and corrupt, it seems, in one way or another. And maybe Carter was just quieter about it. Who knows? Of course, not the last man to challenge the CIA, but the last man to challenge the CIA in any realistic fashion was Richard M. Nixon. And of course, as I've stated many, many times on this program and others, you know, it was just simply too soon to put a bullet into another politician's head. So discrediting and destroying the man is what was done there. And, of course, the wonderful multifaceted discussion about Watergate with Scott Kaiser will give you an idea of the possibilities there. And that we did on, what was it, last Saturday. So, thinking very deeply about, and I'm trying to reach for something here that I can't quite get to, thinking about what's coming up, usually I don't do this, but let's see. You know, I don't have it in front of me. It really doesn't even matter at this point. I'll just finish out my time discussing what it is that's on my mind. But even Mr. Bolden understands that, you know, that incrementally these things have been, you know, extinguished in one way or another as the flames of liberty that we were supposed to understand were part of being born in this alleged nation, right? And I'll tell you why I find that so fascinating, because that's nothing new to anybody who listens to any program like mine at all. But I'll tell you why I find it fascinating is that this is a guy who was obviously, you know, oppressed at the time for the sake of his, well, the complexion of his skin, right? And that is not necessarily the largest concern any longer. It may not be the huge hurdle that it once was. But even coming from that perspective, even looking from then to now, even he questions exactly how much freedom has been lost by all of the American people. What does that tell you? I mean, really, think about that. What does that explain? If somebody who wasn't supposed to go get, and you know what, he was being rather kind about the situation with going and getting the job with Pinkerton and going and getting the job with the Secret Service, and didn't even tell you, even though he did relate to you about the noose being hung over his desk and, you know, particularly offensive illustrations of black people being passed to him, and lots of these comments being made, and, you know, discussing how he didn't belong there, and this is who he was, and, of course, his supervisor, that one gave him quite a startle when his own supervisor decided to tell him that, you know, he was nothing more than a nigger and therefore would always be a nigger, and et cetera, et cetera. I mean, all of that. Here's the funny part in my mind. He's not even telling you all of it, you know. I mean, the complaints and concerns and not taking him along on the road trips because he couldn't stay at hotels, it actually took the personal intervention of the president, which is kind of weird, to sit and scold the head of the Secret Service more than once regarding these issues. And, you know, none of the films, none of the interviews, and I don't even think his book probably fully does justice to the amount of crap this guy went through. And I say once again, with that perspective in hand, what does it tell you that this guy says that our freedoms are being eroded, that we have lost them over time, that they have done nothing but go downhill, that the entire country, the entire situation has done nothing but go downhill ever since then? I mean, do I have to draw this correlation once again? We can go back and say, well, you know, if JFK had lived, he would have finished extracting us from Vietnam, and we would have a much different country today. And some people think that that's extremely idealistic. It's not. The resonant effect that the Vietnam War had on, and here I go, you know, it sounds like hyperbole, but on the soul of this nation is immeasurable. You know, if you consider, okay, there was 58,000 soldiers that died, but there was more than a million men returned back to this country, mutilated in one way or another, whether it be physically, psychologically, or spiritually. Okay, and that's a fair estimate. That's not even probably the full true number. But, I mean, that's a fair estimate of how many men came back to this country. What do you think happens when you have a damaged generation? Eventually they grow, and the ones that didn't, you know, completely descend into some other place were ever after affected. I mean, where do you think, you know, the fathers, the brothers, et cetera, came from 1970s on to now? And I'm definitely talking about my parents' generation, for sure. I mean, I was born in 1972, so I was born while the Vietnam War was still going on, but obviously at the tail end of it. Well, not exactly the tail end, but pretty close. You know, generationally, the Vietnam War was barely a reality to me, but the fallout from it, I promise you, is something that affected my entire generation. You know, that generation they used to call X. Now they've gotten really ridiculous in trying to name people every 3 years or so. I mean, what are we on now? The millennial, post-millennial, homeland generation? I don't even know what to call these kids anymore. But, you know, the generation X, as it was, as it is, was quite affected by this. And it wasn't just because of the loss of family values. How are you supposed to have family values when you have, you know, a dysfunctional cornerstone in each of those families affected in one way or another by the culture that rose up from the Vietnam War? And I'm not even talking about the glorification of protest and things like that, which is largely a Hollywood creation, but it literally changed the atmosphere and the entire sentiment of the nation. I mean, there was definitely an illness in the psychology of this entire nation. We collectively went through it. And then on top of it, a little while later, maybe half a generation later, or maybe it was a full generation later, I'm not sure, but they actually coined the term the post-Vietnam guilt syndrome. And this is why, you know, there's this later return to the overemphasis of embracing veterans now, but not really. See, you notice there's always like a disingenuous sort of fashion to these kinds of things. You know, we went to over-embrace the veterans symbolically with the yellow ribbons, symbolically with the magnets on the back of your car and all those other wonderful things that were most likely made in China in order to expound upon your own personal patriotism in support of the troops. And, oh, I don't support the war, but I support the troops, but I support the war, but I support my politicians, but I trust them, but they're keeping us safe, and we got to fight them over there so we don't fight them over here. And all this nonsense, it all germinated in the soil, okay, in the dirt, in that which decayed and became the soil of the soul of this country, and it's all post-Vietnam. So even if there was half a chance that Kennedy would have followed through on National Security Action Memorandum number 263 and would have completed the withdrawal by the end of 1965 from Vietnam, you mean to tell me you can't recognize that this country would be a far different place? On a local level, I don't mean on a national level, I don't mean in a geopolitical sense, I mean person to person. You don't think that that sort of echoed from that time on? Consider it. That's all I'm saying. Who knows? Maybe I just take this stuff too personally. Well, look, I've got about 15 minutes left, and I'll tell you, if anybody dares to step into my mind when I'm rambling all by myself, 218-339-8525. I'll take anybody that calls in. 218-339-8525. Do apologize for the technical issues and everything else earlier. Sorry about that, guys. And even if you want to drop in some sort of random comment on the Skype, I'll be glad to take that as well. Like I said, things did not turn out exactly as I planned tonight. All the way around, but I do think it was fascinating, and I hope that, you know, you were able to take something from Abraham Bolden's story. But I never work with a script, and, well, here's one of those instances where it's kind of a detriment to me. What are you going to do? Anyway, when I consider that after that period of post-Vietnam guilt syndrome, right? And then we saw the amping up of the, you know, nearly bloodless war, which was, what, the Persian Gulf the first time around? You know, what was it, Operation Desert Shield, then turning into Desert Storm, which gave you trading cards. Mm-hmm. Trading cards. People like Colin Powell and, dear Lord, you know, the other guy's name completely eludes me at this time, but there was another general who was supposedly instrumental in that very surgical, what they called at the time, almost a Nintendo war. And, of course, those of you out there who are a little younger might not understand that, yeah, Nintendo was actually the game system at the time. And, you know, its simple 16-bit graphics were, well, you know, cutting edge, at least for home entertainment purposes. And it seemed as though it was about as real as that. It was also the first time that the cable news networks went over there and covered this stuff extensively, even though we had allegedly live coverage of Vietnam in the 60s. And in the 70s, we didn't have this intimate kind of thing. This is where people like, you know, that still exist today in that medium, like Wolf Blitzer, got their start, et cetera, right? I do believe Christian Amanpour probably emerged right around that time. I don't know. A lot of these news figures, they all become a blur to me. Wolf Blitzer is one of these guys, though, that I do remember at one point being somewhere near Baghdad during bombings or somewhere near Riyadh, or God only knows at this point. It becomes a big scramble. But that gave us the almost guilt-free access into warfare, especially in the Middle East. And once that resonated, well, gee, you know, the horror of war was almost forgotten. The post-Vietnam guilt syndrome gone. The idea that we had lost a war. Believe it or not, that was a big, big issue among people. They talked about it all the time. Oh, we lost a war. We lost a war. doesn't matter that we failed to achieve victory in Korea sometime before that. It doesn't matter that it's kind of really hard to count who the true winners and losers were in what is allegedly World War II, what is allegedly World War I, what is allegedly the Spanish-American War, what is allegedly the Revolutionary War. Because I'll tell you, it's one of the most interesting things to contemplate when you take a look at the actual influences over this country and over our financial system and over our people, etc., etc. It is one of those things to consider sometimes. Did we actually achieve victory in the Revolutionary War in the first place? I know that sounds like a crazy, crazy sort of idea too, doesn't it? But then again, if you would have told someone that, you know, that we'd be having this type of discussion 50 years later about how people were being silenced and shut down regarding the realities of the assassination in 1963... You know, if you would have told somebody that in 1965, 66, 67, you know, before the deluge of individuals who were reexamining and actually questioning the first official conclusion of the United States regarding that assassination, if you were to say it to those people back then, they might have said, there is no way that this hasn't been resolved. It has already been resolved. And even if there were questions remaining, I'm sure that you smart people will figure it out with your brand new technologies in only a couple of years anyway. Meanwhile, we're still applying brand new forensic techniques to the old shabby evidence, and we're still arguing about and discussing all these things. So before I do get out of here, once again, I want you to look up the campaign to exonerate or expunge the record of Abraham Bolden, B-O-L-D-E-N, Abraham spelled just like you think it would be, A-B-R-A-H-A-M, Abraham Bolden. The book is called The Echo from Dealey Plaza, and I know I went off on kind of a strange little rant here, but what can I do? Yeah, I definitely suggest that you take a look at it. I also suggest you take a look at, well, let's see now. I think it's just known as the Chicago Plot article written by Edwin Black in the 1970s for the Chicago Monthly, because the unnamed source in that article who took lie detector tests when attesting to the investigation regarding this fire team that was imported into Chicago, who had apparently been part of a gun-running operation earlier on. Well, you know, those guys that we mentioned tonight? Yeah, well, you know, Abraham Bolden was telling that story to investigative journalist Edwin Black way back then. And if you search on YouTube a little bit, you'll find videos about it. Actually, on my channel, my YouTube channel, the Blind JFK Researcher channel, you'll find a news report from Chicago from some years back explaining about the Chicago plot and things like that, and how, gee, there may have been a very, very similar plot 3 weeks before Dallas to what happened in Dallas. What does that say? Well, either you have multiple conspiracies all over the place that seem to mirror one another, or it was a concerted effort where they just tried several plans and it just happened to come together real nice in Dallas. But anyway, wrongfully convicted, Abraham Bolden, if you check out the trial records, and he was right to correct me that there was actually two trials, and one of them, exactly as he described, as crazy as that sounds, putting himself as lawyer and the public outside of the courtroom, locking them out in order so that he could instruct the jury. And then the very same judge who had made sure to render his opinion to the jury in the previous trial that Mr. Bolden was absolutely guilty and they needed to reconsider, that very same guy locks everybody out like that and then in secret turns around and issues a verdict, which is allegedly collected from the jury, etc., etc. Doesn't that sound quite unbelievable? Well, believe it, that's exactly what happened, and meanwhile, this guy wound up serving the time that he's talking about and being forcibly drugged, and gee, isn't that what a lot of people are afraid of when it comes to trying to tell the truth? Isn't that what a lot of people are afraid of when it comes to speaking some ugly realities about this government? A lesson to be taken, and not just because the man is black or African American, which I found out he's more comfortable with that than being called black, but not just because the man is of that particular ethnicity, but as an American citizen, one to another, is this not something to consider that, you know, sometimes the people that attempt to tell you the most truth are the most punished? And as much as that sickens us, as much as that seems like it is not part of the reality that what is, you know, American, what is supposed to be the conventional behavior of the American system is no longer intact, as much as that may be revolting, repugnant, and ridiculous to most of us, it is nevertheless the reality. So, what else can be said? Not a whole lot, but I'll tell you what, just before I do get out of here, I would like you to go and check out the blog site, which I'm running. And I started work on a blog yesterday and couldn't get it finished because I lost power, internet, everything for the majority of the day. And I did say a couple of days ago that I was going to get back to writing on there. But if you go there, you'll see wrap-ups of this show, links to the archives, links to AFR, American Freedom Radio. All of that is over there at Zen in the Car. Literally, that's what it is. ZENINTHECAR.com/TOE, standing for The Ocelli Effect. And exclusive content will be there available very soon. I've decided to take all the audio content, whether it's pre-recorded or otherwise, and send it through American Freedom Radio, so you may occasionally see a special emerge on the archive page. The only one up there right now is Dr. Edwin Group, and in the first half of the show and in the second half of the show was another something else that happened in an impromptu nature where I was called upon to comment to people in Europe regarding American politics, and believe me, my ranting and raving on there was a whole lot more coherent than you heard tonight. But then again, you know, I was actually all worked up and not looking to simply focus on one story there. I was quite already in the correct mindset to go up and down on everything from the general state of the American politic to the Donald and et cetera, et cetera. So if you want to hear what it's like when I'm just being asked questions as if I were a spokesperson for this country, that's what it sounds like. And in the first hour of that, like I said, with Edwin Group from Global Health Center, you know, he has a lot of interesting information and stuff you need to check out regarding, you know, taking back some of your health in a natural way and utilizing your own body's natural self-healing systems. So we cover a lot of different things here, you know, politics, media, assassinations, etc., etc. That is what it is like to deal with my brain on occasion, and that's why we call it the Ocelli Effect. So once again, people, I do thank you for tuning in, and I'm very sure that something else will be coming up here on American Freedom Radio after me. And by the way, we are listener supported. So if you do go to AmericanFreedomRadio.com to hear this or pick up the archives or whatever, there is a donate banner on the front page. And this network is listener supported just as much as I am listener supported. Like I said, that ZenInTheCar.com/TOE page also has a donate button on it. But the network, myself, we are all out here trying to bring you the truth as best we can. Honest media, baby. The Ocelli Effect is done. Everybody have a good night.
News and information you can trust. This is American Freedom Radio. Freedom, freedom, American Freedom Radio. Radio. American Freedom Radio.
Nutritious food is real body armor. It builds muscle, burns fat, improves digestion, and feeds the entire body the nutrients it needs. Did you know the U.S. government banned the hemp plant from growing in the United States and classified it as a Schedule I drug to hide it behind the marijuana plant? People have been confused about this plant for over 80 years, and many still don't know what hemp is. So now you know hemp is not marijuana, and marijuana is not hemp. They are different varieties of the same species. HempUSA.org wants the world to know these basic facts and to help people understand that hemp protein powder is the best-kept health secret you need to know about. Remember, hemp protein powder contains 53% protein, is gluten-free, anti-inflammatory, non-GMO, and is loaded with nutrients. Call 888-910-4367, 888-910-4367, and see what our powder, seeds, and oil can do for you. Only at HempUSA.org.
What kind of person are you? How do you see yourself? Are you the kind of person that lets everyone else do all the work, just hoping that you'll be able to get some of the crumbs that fall from the table? Or are you the kind of person that rolls up their sleeves and does the dirty jobs that no one else wants to do? Are you hoping that all the activists giving their blood, sweat, and tears to serve humanity are going to solve all the world's problems? Or are you just wondering, is there something simple I can do to contribute? Yes. Yes, there is. Help us. Help us do what we do. Partner up with American Freedom Radio today by gifting a regular amount to support the network and your favorite hosts, bringing you less commercials and more information. Go to AmericanFreedomRadio.com and start donating today from between $1 and $100 per month, according to the kind of person you are. Thank you very much for your support.
We are living in a new era. Partnerships are more important than profit, and gratitude is more respected than greed. As the millennial generation evolves the corporate landscape, our company aims to maximize the achievements of CBD application and push the limits of what's possible by 2020. Our core product matrix and careful cannabidiol purification process are uniquely designed to be privately made in different regions of the world and is geared to assist the efforts of different nations to change the landscape, various pain-related healthcare costs, epilepsy and autism, rising mental disorders, and even soldier suicides. Crystal Pure CBD is made with the industry's finest 99.9% pure CBD crystals. No paste, no filler. Our solution is a permanent answer, and it saves you over one-third in cost. Crystal Pure CBD. Come join us.
You're listening to AmericanFreedomRadio.com, the network who perseveres in delivering intelligent debate, constructive dialogue with true independence. The freedom to broadcast the truth is not free at all. So what is American Freedom Radio worth to you? The empowering information with fun, honest and pure integrity behind it provides an example to follow. Friendships to flourish with the moral altruism that pulls no punches. The hosts sacrifice and show remarkable discipline in their duty to deliver quality radio in service to the community with strength, wisdom, and loyalty. The founders of AFR wish to thank you personally for sharing your views and insights to make the best radio and alternative media. Now it's time for you to give something back and play a vital role in the future of America. Be as generous with us as we've been with you. Click on the donate banner at AmericanFreedomRadio.com or volunteer by emailing AmericanFreedomRadio.com. Vaccines, psychotropic drugs, and artillery batteries not included.
No rules. No rules. No taboo topics. No taboo topics. No fear of doom. No fear of doom. We are. We are. American Freedom Radio. American Freedom Radio.